Teach me, my God and King, in all things thee to see, and what I do in anything to do it as for thee. A servant with this clause makes drudgery divine, who sweeps a room as for thy laws, makes that and the action fine. The poet George Herbert penned these lines as a prayer about his approach to work. You see, all of us at some point, whether we are a boss or an employee, a volunteer, a ministry leader, a teammate or a coach, have difficult aspects of our job or volunteer or team profession, whatever it may be, aspects of our jobs that we might hate or find difficult. And one of the factors that I think we find most difficult in the workplace or team-type environment is managing the relationships we have with those who are bosses, if we're employees, or employees, if we're bosses. Those relationships are often the most difficult in our lives and the most fraught with frustration. Now, chances are that if you've been in a workplace for any considerable length of time, or perhaps on a team or something along those lines, you've been in an environment in which you're working with others and you have met a terrible boss. I mean, maybe it wasn't your boss. Maybe it was your mom's boss or your son's coach or your friend's ministry leader. But the reality is you've met a terrible boss, selfish, cruel, negative, critical, only looking out for number one. Perhaps your boss, or one you know, looked a little something like this.
Morning, everyone. So, I have finally decided who I want to be our new senior vice president of sales. He's right here in this room. It's me.
What do you say?
I've decided to absorb the responsibilities of the senior VP position into my own. I've realized that if you want to get something done right, you've got to do it yourself. So I'm going to be breaking through the wall of the office that would have been the senior VP's and make one huge, enormous office. However, I will only be taking 85% of the additional salary I'm entitled to, and that is self-sacrifice, people.
Mr. Harkin, can I speak to you?
Yeah, sure. What is it?
You know, for months you've been hinting that I was in line for that promotion.
And look how hard you've been working.
What? You just lying to me?
Lying? No, Nick. Motivating. I mean, look, we're all part of the same team here. Plus, you know, I'm the one who's going to be doing all the extra work.
You know that last month you made me work so late, I missed saying goodbye to my gam-gam?
I'm sorry, what?
My grandmother. I told you that I needed to see her because she was very, very sick. You said if I left early, I'd get fired. And she died before I made it to the hospital.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I had no idea that you called your grandmother gam. Sorry. Sorry you didn't get to say bye-bye to Gam Gam. I really But I needed you to stay here and work late because you were an invaluable member of this operation, and I need you in the position that you're currently in.
Not hard to hate that guy, huh? But just as likely, if you've been in a work environment on a team, in a ministry, or even worked on a small group project in high school or college, you've also met a terrible employee, right? Terrible teammate or coworker, lazy, annoying, doing the bare minimum in order to get by. Well, he probably wasn't as honest as this guy. Maybe he looked a little something like this.
Would you walk us through a typical day for you?
Yeah, great.
Well, I generally come in at least 15 minutes late. I use the side door, that way Lumberg can't see me. And after that, I just sort of space out for about an hour.
Space out?
Yeah, I just stare at my desk, but it looks like I'm working. I do that for probably another hour after lunch too. I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Peter, would you be a good sport and indulge us and just tell us a little more?
Oh, yeah. Let me tell you something about TPS reports.
The thing is, Bob, it's not that I'm lazy. It's that I just don't care. And here's something else, Bob. I have 8 different bosses right now.
Beg your pardon?
8 bosses.
8?
8, Bob. So that means that when I make a mistake, I have 8 different people coming by to tell me about it. That's my only real motivation, is not to be hassled. That and the fear of losing my job. But you know, Bob, that'll only make someone work just hard enough not to get fired.
See, now I think the easy thing for most of us to do as we watch these clips is to wrap ourselves in a cocoon of good feelings. And if we're a boss, say, well, I'm nothing like that mean jerk of a boss. Or if I'm an employee or a teammate, I'm nothing like that lazy, good-for-nothing staff member. But this morning, we're in the second week of a lesson series entitled Go to Work. And the reality is, we have got to discern what God has to say about how we can make the boss-employee relationship, which, regardless of which side of that relationship you may be on, the very best it can be. Because the reality is that many of you are a boss to some and an employee to some others. And last week, in the first week of the series, Dad gave a great lesson on the nature of work, that God works, that He created work, and that work is a good and meaningful thing even when it's hard. And he talked about the fact that the average American adult is going to spend 1/3 of their waking life working. Now think about that. Not with family, not with friends, not pursuing meaningful pleasures and pastimes. 33% of your life working. Now, if we're going to manage our careers well or volunteer opportunities well, whatever it may be, if we're going to manage that well, one of the important aspects we have to understand is how to effectively and in a Christ-like manner manage the relationships we have with bosses and employees. So how do we do that? Well, the Bible has plenty to say. Now, our focus verse for this series is actually embedded within the passage that we're going to study today. So we're going to start, and I'm just going to read the passage in full, and when we get to the focus verse within it, then I'll have you guys read this along with me, okay? So it's going to come up on the screens, and I'm going to start with this. Slaves, obey your earthly masters with deep respect and fear. Serve them sincerely as you would serve Christ, not by the way of eye service as people pleasers, but as bond servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart. Now, here's the one we're all going to read together. Here we go. Work with enthusiasm as though you were working for the Lord rather than for people. Paul goes on, remember that the Lord will reward each one of us for the good we do, whether we are slaves or free. Masters, treat yourselves in the same way. Don't threaten them. Remember, you both have the same master in heaven, and he has no favorites. Now, we're going to dive into this passage a little deeper in just a moment, but I want to start by kind of skipping off the surface, all right? Because there are three really fundamental realities that we have to understand about this passage in order to get the most out of it. All right, there are three hard, fundamental realities that we simply must understand if we're going to really, truly understand what Paul is trying to say and why he's trying to say it. Now, those are in the box near the top of your outline, and I'm just gonna go through these as quickly as I can. Right, number one, slavery. There in quotation marks. In other words, slavery. When Paul is talking about it in this particular passage, does not equal American slavery. Slavery doesn't equal American slavery. It never fails that the immediate struggle for many Christians when they stumble across a passage like this is that they immediately route it through the experience of the American Civil War and go, why is the Bible okay with slavery? And isn't slavery bad? And how can we believe in a book that tells slaves to be okay with being slaves and obey their masters? Now, guys, the reality is we could have a whole 60-plus minute lesson on how to read and understand passages in the Bible that deal with slavery because it's a complex issue. And I could go on for a long time about how and why the authors of the Bible didn't come out and try to encourage people to abolish slavery in their time. Trust me, there are good reasons for it. But I'll keep my comments kind of limited to a couple of major things. All right, let's talk first and foremost about the Roman system of slavery, because this is important to understand before we get too far into it. All right, the reality is there were different types of slavery going on in Rome at the time. All right, there was the kind of slavery where your nation got its can kicked in by Rome and you kind of got hauled off and into slavery. And the reality is when that happened, all right, it was a pretty hard life for those folks. Many of those people died pretty quickly. It was difficult and challenging experience for many in that culture. But there was another kind of slavery that was incredibly common in the Roman world at that time, which I think is very pertinent for the discussion that we're going to have today. It worked a little bit like this. Let's say you're a person who's living in the Roman world and you've become riddled with debt for some reason. All right, could be a bunch of reasons, but you've got a lot of debt, and you know you don't have the income to pay for it and to get yourself out of debt. So what many people would do in this particular time frame is they would sell themselves as slaves to their debtors. By working for that debtor for an agreed upon period of time, the individual would pay off their debt. And the reality is that there's good historical evidence indicating that slaves of this nature often earned their freedom, all right? They made money, they had families that weren't split apart and moved all over the kingdom, all right? Let me be clear. There's a variation of experiences among slaves in the Roman world, and some people had it very hard, all right? But there were many in that world that experienced something that's not all that different than an average person in the United States of America. I said that on purpose, and some of you are freaking out right now. JD, what are you talking about? Right? Hang with me. The Institute for College Access and Success ran a research initiative called the Project on Student Debt in 2015. And here's what they discovered. 68% of the 2015 graduates with a bachelor's degree, four-year bachelor's degree, walked out of college with student loan debt. In other words, 68% of all the kids that went to college walk out with a pile of debt. And per borrower, so almost 70% of the kids that went to college, on average, they walked out of college with a debt load of minimum $30,100. 22-year-olds, on average. In the United States, Federal Reserve has run some interesting statistics on average American debt. So they took all of the households in America, all of them, and here's what they found. The average debt per American household, including all the ones that have none, is $137,063. All right? So the average American sitting in this room today is swimming in quite possibly $160,000+ worth of debt. And the reality is, the Bible makes it pretty clear that if you owe somebody money and you don't have the cash to pay it, you're a slave. Proverbs 22, verse 7, "The rich rule over the poor, and the borrower is the slave to the lender." So there it is in black and white. If you have major debt and no cash to pay for it, you are a slave. So what do American slaves do? Well, we go out and we look for someone who's hiring workers. And we agree to sell them a specific amount of time and skill for a specific amount of money. And if we sell them enough time, we can make enough money to pay off our debts. Does that sound familiar? You see, when Paul is talking about slaves and masters, certainly with some individuals in that particular culture and in that particular time frame, it was an awful, challenging, terrible existence. But for many, it was simply the process of paying off debt through what kind of amounted to employment. You see, it's not all that much different. I mean, it's different. We live in a free culture. They didn't. Right? But we have to understand, they may have dealt with difficult masters, they may have dealt with kind of a difficult situation in life, but we face many of the same experiences. The second thing that we have to note about Roman slavery was that it was not particularly race-based. All right? It just wasn't. Anyone could be a slave if they racked up enough debt. And no one was importing a specific race of people on slave ships to the Roman world. It just didn't happen that way. All right, so we have to get beyond our kind of fundamental perceptions of the idea of slavery if we're gonna make any sense of this passage. All right. Now, the second hard reality evident in this passage is one that we have to face head on. And it's this: the world will never be fair. The world will never be fair. Inequity, in other words, the fact that some people have more and less, inequity is a reality that will not change. The very first line of this passage says, "Slaves, obey your earthly masters." In other words, the reality is there will always be some people with more and some people with less. All right, more talent, more money, more privileges, more opportunities. There will always be someone with more than you, and there will always be someone with less than you. And Jesus himself said it this way. He said, Mark 14:7, he said, "The poor you will always have with you." Now, let me be clear. I don't think Jesus is walking around espousing some especially beautiful reality. I mean, he's not going, "Yay, there's always going to be poor people. How cool." Like, he's not doing that. He's just telling us the truth. What he's saying is we have to get used to the idea that there will always be fundamental inequities in the world because we live in a fallen world. And we live in a world in which God created us a little bit different than one another. And you can't always make that equal. Let me give you a perfect example. I can't make me and LeBron James athletically equal. He's 6'8", 275, and he can run the length of the floor in 3.5 seconds. Like, I could get to the foul line in that time, right? Like, I can't make him and me the same. And it doesn't matter how much we try to take from him and give to me, I will never be him. And he will never be me. All right? And the reality is, he has a fundamental skill that will allow him to be paid millions and millions and even maybe a billion by the time he's dead, dollars. And I don't have that skill. But I have other skills that he doesn't have, and you can't make him equal to me in certain categories. And so you have to think about it. None of us are perfectly the same as anybody else. And one of the things that I see happening in our world is that people are polarizing around two very different perspectives. And I think we have to be really careful about it if we're Christians. On the one side, for lack of a better term, and this is maybe going to come off a little harsh, but just kind of go with me here. On the one side, I think we're kind of polarizing toward what I'm going to call class envy. Right? Class envy. In other words, we look at the fundamental inequity in our culture. We see people with more and people with less, right? And we automatically assume that the people on the wealthy or privileged or powerful end did something wrong in order to get there. I mean, it's an assumption that we make. And the end result of that behavior from a biblical perspective is something condemned in the Ten Commandments, and it's covetousness. Covetousness, right? Ten Commandments say, don't covet. Don't cover your neighbor's stuff. And basically, covetousness works like this. I don't have what they have, and I'd like to have more of what they have. And I think they should be brought down to my level so that they don't have as much of what they currently have, and I've got a little bit more of what they've got. Right? You see, we see this in our culture every day, and it's a problem because it's both a denial of reality, and it's a sinful approach to solving the problem. Let me explain that a little bit. To be envious of somebody else and to kind of want to take from somebody else, it's a denial of reality because it assumes that we can all be equal. We can't. We are not the same. all of us, fundamentally different from one another. So we can't possibly be the same. We can't have all the same skills. We can't have all the same money-making ability. We can't have all the same intellect. We can't have all the same capacities. It's not possible. So it's a denial of reality to go in this direction. At the same time, it's also a sinful way of solving the problem, because the Bible is clear, thou shalt not steal, right? And when you take from somebody in order to give to somebody else for no reason other than just to even things out, the reality is that's a sinful approach. The Bible calls that sin, right? And it's a sin to want to have that done to people, right? It's coveting. At the same time, however, on the other side of the equation, you have people building up exorbitant wealth, making more and more and more and seeking more and more and more, and who accept the radical inequality of our world, who accumulate vast sums of money, and who in their greed, right, see no need to serve those who are in less privileged positions. And something that we have to understand is when we look at the Bible, we look at Jesus, we look at Paul, we look at the writers of the Bible, what we find is that they're not on either end, they're in the middle. They're in the middle. They understand the world we live in. They accepted clearly that we live in a world in which there will always be some with more money and some with less. Some with more power and privilege, some with less. Some with more access and opportunity, some with less. They understood that in a fallen world, there would be people born in better school districts, people born with parents or grandparents who were wealthy. And at the same time, so on one hand, they accepted the reality that the world is not fair. On the other side of it, however, they argued for the single most radical generosity ethic that the world has ever seen. You read the New Testament, and what Jesus and Paul and all of them say is that rich people are not to be envied. They say over and over and over, share, get rid of some of your wealth, do what you can to give away some of what you have to serve those who have less, because the reality is your wealth will be the single most tempting thing that will cause you to walk away from God. We have to understand there will always be bosses and there will always be employees. And the sooner we remember that, the more we'll be better able to live and understand the world in which we live. Finally, this passage clearly points out a third fundamental and difficult reality. Regardless of the position you occupy in life, whether a boss or an employee, you will always live under authority. You will always live, there is not a day of your life that you will not be living under authority. It's simple, but it can't be overlooked. Ephesians 6:5, slaves, obey your earthly masters with deep respect and fear. Serve them sincerely as you would serve Christ. So in other words, every day of your life you will have masters, bosses, employers, parents, teachers, political and social authorities like the police that will have authority over you. But then he goes and throws God in there who reminds us that we will have human authorities in this life, but then we will also have God. Let me kind of give you an example. All right, this might be kind of hokey, but this is hopefully it's fun for you. All right, so here we go. Let's say you just got a job. You're a line worker in a factory. You're the bottom of the totem pole guy, right? So like this is your level of authority, okay? This is you. All right, you're basically just responsible for you and getting there on time, right? That's about all you got. All right, and you have a supervisor, right? The supervisor is maybe that shift, okay? And so he's got a little more authority than you, make sure everybody's kind of doing their job, but not a ton of authority, but just a little more than you, right? And so then he's got a shift supervisor over, or he's got a supervisor over him. So you, shift supervisor. Now you got kind of the business owner, right? So this guy reports to him. He's the guy running the show, running the business. But how does he run a business? Well, he's kind of got to be a part of, he's got to run his business in accordance with the laws of the land. Well, who passes the laws of the land? Well, that's Congress, right? So Congress, you know, passes laws. And you know, who has to sign those into effect? The president, right? So you got the president. And well, who elects the president? Well, all the people, right? So, oh, wait, God. Right? So you got all this line of authority, you got all these different people, and everybody is just kind of a gradual step up of human authority, and you got all this authority kind of going up the chain, God overall. Right? This is what's going on. I mean, it's kind of the same, like I stayed up way too late watching the Ohio State game last night, right? Pretty cool game. But like I'm a football player at Ohio State, right? And I got a position coach. And an offensive or defensive coordinator who reports to the head coach, who reports to the athletic director, who reports to the president of the university, who reports to, you know, I mean, obviously the controlling bodies of, you know, accrediting bodies or whatever. God. Right? We can do this all day. You see, the reality is you and I will live under two sets of authority all the time. We'll have all these human authorities operating over us, and then God as the ultimate authority over all. Now, some of you in your minds, you're really smart because you're good Bible readers and you've read Matthew 6:24. No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to one and despise the other. These are the words of Jesus. So you can't serve two masters. You can't, I mean, so if it's going to come down to God or people, well, it's God. I don't have to listen to all these people. Hold up a second. Let's go back to the passage. Slaves, obey your earthly masters with deep respect and fear. Serve them sincerely as you would serve Christ. In other words, your service to your employers or to the bosses or to the ascending levels of human authority, your service to these entities is your service to God. When you serve an authority figure over you well, with a smile on your face and a commitment to doing well by them, then you are serving Christ. When you attempt to undermine or harm or rebel against or disobey a human authority, your ultimate disobedience is to God. This is a reality we have to understand. And here's what I want to do with the rest of our time today. I want to get really practical because this is a super practical passage. It's basically giving us a rundown of what we should do and not do in our employer-employee relationships. And again, you can run the same game with teams and sports stuff and, you know, volunteer opportunities, all that kind of thing. All right, I want to approach it from both angles. What do I owe an employer if I'm an employee? So if I'm down here at the bottom of the scale and I've got people over me, what do I owe these individuals? And if I'm kind of somewhere up here, maybe I'm kind of a big deal, right? At my place of work. You know, there's like four layers of people underneath me. Well, what do I owe all of these people? That's where we're going to go today. So we're going to start where the passage starts, and that's with employees, right? The first thing, those of us that are in an employee position or a volunteer position or a teammate position, whatever you want to call it, is that we owe them obedience with respect. Obedience with respect. Paul says it clearly, slaves, obey your earthly masters with deep respect and fear. And what's fascinating is that Paul seems to make no distinction between how you serve a great boss or a terrible one. See, it doesn't say, slaves, obey your good and Christian and kind earthly masters. No. It just says, obey your masters. And some of you are thinking, well, JD, what about those bosses or leaders that are taking us the wrong direction who don't treat me well? Well, the reality is the Bible does give you one out to disobey those in authority over you. The Bible gives you one very clear out. If you're this guy, you have one reason for disobeying any of the people in this line. It's when the people in this line tell you to disobey him. It's the only out. You can read the book from cover to cover, start to finish, front to back, whole Bible. You'll get one instruction: follow the orders and do what you're supposed to do and obey with respect unless they tell you to disobey him. It's the only out that we are given in Scripture. And remember, he is talking about people who sold themselves into slavery to pay off debt at best, or at worst, were just kind of caught up in, hey, my nation got beat by Rome, and so here I am a slave. Like, this is who he's talking to. And he's saying, obey and be respectful and be kind and do what you're supposed to do. I mean, not all of these masters were nice, but he called them to obey nonetheless. Which means that those of us who work every day or serve every day in voluntary environments, right? We don't have to go to the same job every day. We can go get a new one if we want to. Many of us have fabulous job mobility. If we so choose, we could go do something else. So those of us in a voluntary environment should be very careful when we try to undermine or disrespect the boss. Secondly, we owe our boss dependability. Paul made this statement in 1 Corinthians 4:2. Those who are trusted with something valuable must show that they are worthy of that trust. You see, when somebody hires you, they are entrusting you to do an important job. I'll never forget it. It was 2008. I had just graduated from my master's in counseling program. I was 25 years old, and my boss handed me a job. Gave me a computer, gave me keys to a building, and by the way, said, go help these people who are addicted to a substance to stop. I'm 25 years old, and he's literally handing into my area of responsibility individuals who might otherwise die if they don't get better. I'm 25 years old. He's put equipment and money and time and people into my hands. One of my job responsibilities was to help children with behavioral disorders get over their typical ways of behaving. I mean, that's important stuff to hand to a 25-year-old guy. I could go on. Your boss has entrusted you to work hard because he's giving you money, he's giving you his business, he's giving you his inventory, his product, his equipment. We are responsible for ensuring that our efforts are commensurate with that trust. The boss that is trusting us with responsibility is deserving of our dependability. That's pretty good. You might want to write that down. Right. The boss that is trusting us with responsibility is deserving of our dependability, even if they're annoying micromanagers. Thirdly, we owe our bosses right motives. We owe our bosses right motives. Now, this is Ephesians 6:6, and you might have noticed on the outline I changed translations because this particular translation just really jumped out at me and it gave me a lot to think about. He says, so obey your earthly masters with deep respect and fear like you would do if you were serving Christ. And then he says, not by way of eye service as people pleasers, but as bondservants of Christ doing the will of God from the heart. In other words, he's saying, don't just do what you're supposed to do when they're looking. See, I think there's a couple different temptations that we can fall into at work as it pertains to eye service. And that first one is the number one. It's kind of the guy we saw in the clip, right? I'll do just what I have to do when I know they're looking in order to make sure that I don't lose my job. Right? That's eye service temptation number one. Right? Just kind of do what I have to do to not get in trouble. But I think there's a second form of eye service that we really have to watch out for. It's a little different. It means, I think it looks like this. It means going above and beyond so that we're recognized for it. To gain the glory and attention of the boss, pleasing him or her so that we will ultimately get what we want out of them. That's also eye service. Right, on the one side, we've got this part of us that's like, you know, oh, I'll do what I have to do, just not lose my job. But on the other side, it's sneaky, right? But hey, I want to get promoted. I want to make more money. I'm gonna like go way above and beyond. I'm gonna do what I can. I'm gonna make sure the boss knows I'm here. I'm gonna, you know, really work hard in front of him so that you know I'll be the first in line, right? You see, Paul tells us not to fall into either trap. He says, instead, work hard every day with the motivation that you will serve Christ, doing the will of God for you, which is to be the very best employee that you can be. He says, that will help you avoid the first temptation, because if you're working as hard as you can, then you're not just sloughing off and you know, doing what you have to do to get by. But it will also help you to avoid the second temptation. Because when you just do your best because that's what God calls you to do, then you can sit back and allow him to determine whether or not you have opportunities for advancement. You don't have to work extra hard just to please the boss. You can just please God and allow him to take care of whether or not you have additional opportunities. Finally, we owe our bosses our prayers. Let me be honest. How often do you pray for your boss? How often do you pray for the board or the managers or the supervisors at your workplace? Guys, you should. Paul says to his friend Timothy in 1 Timothy 2, verse 1, first of all, then, I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgivings be made for all people, for kings and for all who are in high positions. You see, Paul, same writer of the passage that we're talking about today, says to his friend Timothy, who's running a church, I want you to make sure that people are praying for the people that are in authority over them. Pray for those people, even if you don't like them, even if they're frustrating, even if they don't treat you with the respect you feel you deserve, pray for them. Guys, it's hard, and I haven't always done this well myself, but we need to do it. So that's a short list of the things that we as employees owe employers. Now, let's talk just for a second about what employers owe employees. And the first thing's pretty simple. All of the above. All of the above. In other words, if you are an employer, you owe your people all of the things that they owe to you. First of all, respect, and even at times, obedience. Okay? Now, I have the privilege of operating as a staff member here, and I have lots and lots of meetings with lots and lots of volunteers within this organization and lots of other staff members, and so many of the meetings that I walk into, just by nature of the fact that I'm employed and I have a certain level of responsibility here at GNG, in many of the cases, I walk into those meetings as the boss, if you will. All right? I certainly don't try to lord it over people, but that's the reality. I walk in with a certain amount of responsibility for this organization. And yet, in a lot of those meetings, despite the fact that I walk into them as the boss, if you will, right, I take direction from other leaders and volunteers and church attenders who have great ideas and who have wisdom for me to consider. I owe that to them. Despite the fact that I might be in a position of authority over them as it pertains to this particular organization, the reality is if they have something good for this church, if they have something good that's going to make this church more effective in accomplishing its mission, then I owe them to obey them in doing what it is they encourage me to do. Secondly, as an employer, I owe my employees dependability, and so do you. We read that passage, we read the passage before, but I want to read it again. Those who are trusted with something valuable must show they are worthy of that trust. And the reality is, when you're a boss, you have been entrusted with people. God's most precious possession. There is nothing more valuable than the people in your care. You owe your employees the right motives. I think one of the great sadnesses that we hear about on a fairly regular basis is when some corporate CEO or high-ranking official takes advantage of people in his organization in order to obtain more money and status. Stories like that engender an inherent distrust in those of us. who are reading them. And the reality is that it's the responsibility of those in employer positions to serve people with the right motives. And those of us in employer situations also owe the people that we are in authority over our prayers. We do. So what employers owe employees is exactly the same thing as employees owe employers. But my dad told me a long time ago, and I've lived to see it become true, that you give up as you go up, is a phrase he loves to use. In other words, as you climb the ladder of authority and as you move up the rungs of responsibility and authority, you also give up certain freedoms, you give up certain rights, and you take on additional responsibilities. And there are some additional responsibilities that employers have. Secondly, and namely, to pay appropriately and on time. If you're an employer, you owe it to your people to pay them appropriately and pay them on time. James 5:4 says, this is James, you know, the half-brother of Jesus, writing to believers, and he's talking very specifically to rich believers in this particular passage. And he says, look, the wages you failed to pay the workers who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. You see, God seems to take the situation surrounding employees in this world very seriously. And in the book of James, God issues a direct warning to those who are wealthy employers, saying, if you've got money in your pocket and it belongs to somebody else, trust me, I know. And for those of you who are regular readers of the Bible, that phrase, crying out, might strike you as somewhat familiar. If it does, it should. In the very first book of the Bible, Genesis, we read about the story of Cain killing his brother Abel. And God comes to Cain and says, what have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. So in other words, the same phrase that God uses about murder, he uses about unpaid wage to employees. That should be thought-provoking for those of us in employer-type situations. Those of us in leadership or employer positions should be very careful about shorting our employees because God knows. Finally, employers owe it to our employees to be considerate. To be considerate. And what I mean by that is simply this. Be considerate of the fact that there is a power difference between you. You have much leverage in the relationship and they do not. We have to handle that with care, right? So if you're up here and you're talking to a person down here, you have an amount of power and leverage that this person does not have. And you have to be very considerate in dealing with those individuals because the reality is they can't hit you as hard as you can hit them, right? Oops. Ephesians says this. Don't threaten them. He says, be considerate. Don't threaten them. Remember, you have both the same, you both have the same master in heaven, and he has no favorites. In a similar kind of parallel passage in the book of Colossians, chapter 4, Paul basically says the same thing. Masters, provide your slaves with what is right and fair, because you know that you also have a master in heaven. So what Paul says is be considerate about the fact that you have a little bit more power than your employees. You have a little bit greater positional authority than them because the reality is there's always God at the end of that line and he's got plenty more than you. Remember that. And it's only by his grace that we live and move and have our being, as the Bible says. And the reality is, we have someone in authority over us that we are responsible to. I remember listening to Dave Ramsey tell a story about an employee whose son was involved in a major car accident. He was in a coma for 6+ months. Now, the mother of this particular young man worked for Dave Ramsey. And she was a good employee, conscientious, on time, did what she was supposed to do, good employee. But because of the situation with her son, she was out for like 6 months. Didn't come to work. And I remember hearing Dave Ramsey talk about the fact that he paid every dime of her salary for the entirety of that time. And on top of it, helped pay for some of the son's expenses. You see, the reality is he remembered that he was under God's authority, and how he treated his employees and how he was considerate of his employees was an indication of how he served Christ. And the bottom line for this lesson this morning is a quotation that I found in my research from a Scottish pastor named Alistair Begg. It's an important quote, and one I believe applies equally for employers and employees. Alistair Begg said this. He said, "The most willing service is provided by those who are most interested in serving Jesus." The most willing service, in other words, when you and I are most committed to serving Jesus, we will do the most willing service. We will be at our very best, regardless of the station in life in which we find ourselves. So if the most important thing for you as an employee is serving Jesus, then you will do well in your relationship with your boss. Right? If you're an employee and your highest aim is to serve Jesus, it will come out in how you handle even the most frustrating of bosses. And if you're a boss or a leader and your highest aim is to serve Jesus, then it will show in the love and the kindness of your treatment of those underneath you. But if our goal isn't to serve Jesus, if we are most interested in serving ourselves, then rest assured it will come out in how we treat those both under and over us. Now, in that box on the back of your outline, there are a few things for you to consider. Some next steps for this week, if you will. All right, number one is you may be in the room today and you may be a person who's kind of thinking through the idea of faith and you wondering what it means to be a follower of Christ. And you're asking yourself the question, well, I wonder if I do believe this stuff. Maybe you have some questions or some things you would like to consider or some conversations you would like to have. On the back of your communication card, there's some boxes you can check. One for if you have spiritual questions or if you're interested in getting baptized or you want to know a little bit more about what it means to follow Jesus. If you would just check those and then drop them in the communication card bin in the back, somebody from the church office will get with you this week. But if you're an employer, I just want to ask you a question today. If you're an employer, I want to challenge you maybe this week. Spend some prayer time on this. Maybe journal about it. But ask yourself the question, am I creating a work environment in which the people that work under me know what it's like to have Jesus as a boss? Now, don't get me wrong. You're not going to be perfect. You're not the Son of God. So the reality is you're not going to be Jesus. But to the best of your ability, ask yourself the question, am I creating a work environment so that the people that are operating underneath me kind of have a sense of what it might be like for Jesus to be their boss? And if you're an employee or just a volunteer or just a member of a team, you know, what would it be like? And ask yourself the question, and maybe journal about it this week, or pray about it, or think about it. What would it be like? Am I creating a work environment in which my boss knows what it's like to have Jesus on staff, on the team? Jesus being one of the role players. What would that be like? Am I creating that? Guys, may it truly be said of us that we worked hard and worked lovingly on behalf of Christ and others, regardless of our station in life or our position on the workplace totem pole. Teach me, my God and King, in all things thee to see. And what I do in anything, to do it as for thee. A servant with this clause makes drudgery divine. Who sweeps a room as for thy laws makes that and the action fine. Father God, we come to you today thanking you for this opportunity. To be in this place today, to be in this room, to know you as our God and King. And Father, I pray that in all things today we will honor you to the best of our ability. But most especially, Father, in all things as we go to work tomorrow, as we step into a volunteer opportunity or play whatever role we have to play on a team this week. Father, I pray that in all things we would do it as for you, with the respect that comes with being a follower of yours. Father, I have to believe that if each and every one of us were to do that, I have to believe that if every single one of us today made the decision that we were going to live like that in the workplace, on our teams, in the volunteer environments in which we go, I have to believe that if we did that, oh Father, we would turn the world upside down. And there would be so many people asking the question, what is it about these folks that makes them so good and so loving and so respectful and so committed to what they do? I pray that would be said of us. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.